Welcome back, and thank you for tuning in. I'm Pierre Daly, Managing Director at AdvisorAnalyst.com, and this is Insight is Capital. Jason Buck, Chief Investment Officer at Mutiny Fund, is our guest. After living through 2008 as a commercial real estate developer, Jason became focused on how investors could better manage their risk. He spent the following decade consulting on portfolio construction and building bespoke long volatility strategies for family offices and high net worth individuals. This experience in cross-asset class trading spotlighted the need to create a portfolio that combined both offensive and defensive strategies. And together with partner Taylor Pearson at Mutiny Fund, Jason primarily oversees the investment strategy and manager selection. They first developed and brought what they call the cockroach investment strategy to market in 2021. And as they put it, cockroaches aren't cuddly, but they do two things really well that we want also in our portfolios. They're hard to kill and they compound fast. What a terrific analogy. And they're hard to kill and they compound fast. I love that. Now they've rolled out their defense strategy. So stay tuned and thank you for listening.
This is the Insight is Capital podcast.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
Jason, welcome back. It's great to have you on this show and to catch up with you.
Yeah, Pierre, it's great to see you again. Excited always to have a chat. And I appreciate the intro. And cockroaches are always controversial topics. Some people, you know, hate them. Some people love them. Yeah, we've learned to love them ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, you know, my reaction when I first, you know, caught wind of the name of your strategy, the cockroach strategy. And, you know, as you pointed out, it's quite a visceral choice of names for a strategy. But it's, I mean, it evokes exactly, you know, in the end, like once you've settled on your reaction, you know, I couldn't help but thinking that's a really brilliant way to get the attention that it deserves.
Yeah, I think that every entrepreneur knows, like, right, they have a business idea and then they want to come up with a name, and then a quick Google search, you find out like every name's taken, right? And then Especially in hedge fund space, everybody's using either, you know, ancient Greek, you know, mythology names, you know, and or these three-letter acronyms. And I find like everybody forgets those. And so we kind of went out on a limb to, you know, just call it cockroach because it's evocative of what we're trying to do.
Right.
And most importantly, people remember it, even if they hate the name, which most people told me they do hate the name. I'm like, will you remember it? And what do cockroaches do? They survive anything. And I'm like, that's all I need you to do is just remember it and be evocative of what we're trying to produce as a firm.
Well, I think when people are, you know, perhaps licking their wounds at those critical moments in time when markets are, you know, in transition from good to bad very quickly in some cases, that's when you think, you know, I should have done something more, right? And, you know, investors in general, I mean, it's very broad swath. The majority of investors are woefully diversified or under, you know, at least at the very minimum, under diversified. And then they also often fail to consider and I don't know whose fault that is in the end. Depends on you know, how they're seeking advice. But you know, if you don't look at your personal situation against your investments, and this is something that we'll get into in our conversation, which is that, you know, very investors sometimes look at their portfolios in isolation from the rest of their financial matters, when in fact, you know, if you're an entrepreneur, for example, you know, you really have to sort of, you know, you really have to integrate your thinking into everything you do so that you're not getting caught out in your business as well as your portfolio at the same time. You know, ideally, one offsets the other, and you have a defense strategy in place, a true defense strategy. You recently launched your defense strategy, which is a little less visceral of a name than cockroach. but you know, again, I have to say my reaction to launching a defense strategy is in relation to, you know, all the offensive investments people own in their portfolio, right? And then, you know, I like the play on words too. I mean, we've had this play on words, you know, those are really offensive investments that you own. right? You know, those equities and those bonds, Jesus, you know, those are damn offensive. Offensive, right? But in sports, and you know, you coming from an athletic background as well as, you know, as a student athlete in your past, you know, team building applies to portfolio construction, right? The theory of team building applies to portfolio construction. And there's some aspects and some interesting examples that you point out that we'll get into as well, such as, you know, the football analogy from the Herschel Walker syndrome. But we'll get into that later in the conversation. But you recently launched your defense strategy. So, Jason, let's just start with, why defense? Why now?
Sure. Yeah, there's so many things you said in there. And you know, I'll draw on a few of them. You know, my good buddy Matt Baber wrote a paper too about, you know, how like financial advisors are almost triple or quadruple leveraged to the market. You know, like they don't realize how much they need some defensive asset classes, right?
Yeah.
If their clients are tied to like a long stock or a long 60-40 portfolio, that means, you know, as it goes down, you know, their clients might want to pull. So the revenue for the firm goes down. They may lose their job. You know, everything's really tied to the markets more than they realize. And so one of the things we always thought about is what we do as more like an entrepreneurial hedge for business. The other one you said, like, you know, why do people get so stuck on what they're doing and use all of these offensive assets? It's a lot of it's probably recency bias, but I got reminded when you're reading my bio, it said, you know, I survived 2007, 2008, or I survived in that I'm alive today, but I got crushed in 2007, 2008.
Right.
And it's what we call, you know, in the US, what we call GFC, the Great Financial Crisis. And it put up a flag for me because just last week I was talking to a fellow Canadian firm out of Toronto that was a multifamily office, and I used the acronym GFC. And they had to explain it to some of the people in the office that Great Financial Crisis was 2007 for real estate in the U.S. and 2008 in the U.S. for the stock market.
Right.
Because, like, as you know, Canadian housing has not hit that dip that we had in the U.S.
Exactly.
That was absolutely devastating, right? So, like, you still have, like, the Canadian and Australian housing markets never went through the devastation that the U.S. markets went through in 2007, 2008 when that liquidity dries up. So that was just, it was kind of fresh on my mind thinking about the recency bias of that. You know, when we think about portfolios, at a high level, our subtitle not only is Cockroach Fund, our flagship fund, but what we always try to say is offense plus defense wins investing
right.
championships. And we feel like everybody's portfolio of what they believe are well-diversified assets are truly just offensive assets. Those offensive assets are doing great in a rising GDP environment, in a rising liquidity environment. And those offensive assets are, you know, stocks, bonds, private equity, venture capital, real estate, they all do really well and rise linearly in kind of these growth environments that we tend to experience for like a decade at a time. But then when a liquidity crunch happens or a sell-off happens, you know, these, as you hear, the correlations go to one and all of them
right.
go down together. Because you might think you're diversified, but in liquidity crunch, correlations go to one, you find out those are all offensive assets. And so what we were always trying to do is like, how do you pair offense with defensive assets? That way your clients, you know, can reduce that left tail of those drawdowns, and that way they compound their wealth more efficiently and effectively over time. So at a high level, we think about combining just offensive and defensive assets in a portfolio. And that's what our total portfolio solution is with Cockroach Fund. The other way we look at it is through the classic kind of four quadrant model that was originally popularized by Harry Brown. And the idea is you're always you're either in one of the four quadrants on the axes of growth or inflation, right? We're either in growth
right.
or recession, inflation or deflation. And they're kind of a Venn diagram. They overlap a bit, but that's kind of the way we look at portfolio. So like in classical Harry Brown, for growth, you use stocks. For deflation or disinflation, you use bonds. For recessions, you use cash. And for inflation, you use gold. And so in that rubric of Harry Brown's simplified four quadrant model, the offensive assets would be stocks and bonds, and the defensive assets would be cash and gold. And so that would be his combination. Now, if Harry Brown were alive today, we feel like he could have used much more advanced portfolio techniques that we try to incorporate into what we build. So in our sense, on the defensive side, instead of using cash, we really like the convexity you can get from long volatility and tail risk,
right.
kind of like an insurance provision. Like, you know, you have your you know, you're trying to maybe reduce your left tails to like a negative 20% drawdown, you know, that's your deductible, everything. And then you have a coverage beyond that that tends to have a lot of convexity to it. But just like insurance, you know, they can have a premium bleed to that while you're waiting for that maybe once in a decade event to happen. And then on the other side, where Harry Brown used gold for inflation, we just feel that commodity trend advisors have a much higher beta to inflation historically than just gold does, because gold is just a singular asset class. People like to debate about gold all the time. And you hear that, you know, gold upholds its purchase power parity over the centuries, but maybe not in any intervening years or decades, right? Like sometimes, you know, in March of 2020, when we had that liquidity cascade, a lot of times, you know, not only do the correlations go to one-year offensive assets, but even gold might be going down in that acute month there because everybody's just trying to go to cash. They're selling, they're throwing out the baby at the bathwater.
Yeah, liquidity.
Yeah, yeah. They just need liquidity. So you might see them, they don't want to sell their gold positions, but you might see them sell their gold positions. So
well, that was the thing. And I'm sorry, I hate to interrupt you, but I just want, you know, like the reason Bernie Madoff got caught when he did was because his fund looked like it was performing perfectly when everything else was in this correlation rising to one period where you know, everything is selling off. Oh my God, you know, I'm gonna go Madoff and get my money to shore up my account. And of course, you know, it turns out, oh, there was no money, right? It was all gone. It wasn't really providing that offset that everybody thought that it was. You know, I'm always amused by that revelation, which is that, you know, of all the things to get caught for, it's when people need money and they turn to you and you're supposedly the source of capital and you don't have it, that even gold in those moments of crisis will be a you know, a source of funding for margin calls on capital, raising capital for your portfolio. People are going to turn obviously to the most liquid assets that they can when they need to.
That was a perfect analogy. Like you said, it's the old cliche of like, when the tide goes out, we see who's swimming naked, right?
And that's exactly. Yeah.
Swimming naked, right? and that's why I love about like on the defensive side, and we'll maybe get into this, is these highly liquid instruments are a source of liquidity when people need it most. And, you know, the good and bad of that is for the managers that run funds like this, that do defensive funds, you know, usually they're getting a lot of the redemptions, right? Because people need capital so bad. So they're the ones that can provide it because everybody else has gates and they've locked up their liquidity and there's not, you know, or they're trying to catch a falling knife. So in a perverse way, like they're the ones providing that cash when people need it most. But going back to commodity trend following, you know, it's a bit of an esoteric market. It's been called, you know, terrible naming. It's been called managed futures, trend following, CTAs, all these sorts of things. But the general idea is in the future space, you have, you know, up to 80, you know, traditional liquid markets, and those cover like a lot of the commodity inputs that we see around the world, right? So you can have everything from energies to, you know, on energies from oil to nat gas to crack spreads, everything. You can have metals, you know, across gold, copper, silver. You can have, you know, your softs from cotton, cocoa, coffee, orange juice, into your meats, pork bellies, you know, like that classic trading places.
You got
your pork belly. You got your four valleys, your feeder cattle, all of those sorts of raw commodity inputs. And the point of what trend followers technically do is they tend to, you know, just ride the trends up and down. So they will participate in a rising market, but they'll also participate on the short side in the declining market across these vast different allocations they can get in the managed future space. And the reason
why they'll go long into rising price markets. And they'll go short into falling price markets.
Yeah, so they'll, right? The classic, you know, it's counterintuitive for most people, right? Because most people understand from like a Warren Buffett perspective that you want to like buy low, sell high, where trend followers will buy high and sell higher,
or
sell low and then sell lower. Like, so then they're kind of trying to capture the belly or the meat of that move, either down or up in those markets. And so then you get that bi-directional flavor of it. And then more importantly, it's more of those commodity inputs that you would see in a rising inflationary environment. That's what I was saying. It has a higher beta, hopefully, to inflation than gold, because you have more shots on gold, so to speak. You have more ways to play that trade, both long and short. All of those kind of commodity inputs around the world, where gold is just kind of a singular instrument. And so that's why we believe that using CTAs, and maybe we'll get into later why an ensemble of CTAs is probably best in our opinion, but that's why we feel that's a better coverage for an inflationary environment. So we combine those offensive assets in the cockroach portfolio, like global stocks and global bonds, with our defensive assets like tail risk, commodity trend advisors. And we do all still hold a little bit of gold, physical gold, and a tiny bit of cryptocurrencies, just in case those angry Bitcoiners are right. You know, who knows right. if they will be in the future. I'm not one to debate it.
Now, in past conversations, you know, we've talked about ensembles. We've talked about the different kinds, you know, the different term commodity trend advisors, which are, you know, there's short-term advisors. These are basically short-term CTAs. There's medium-term CTAs and there's long-term CTAs. And you want to combine the three different categories of CTAs so that depending on what's happening with timing, you know, as Corey Hofstein has pointed out many times, and timing and timing luck, you know, you want to, because, like, for example, March 20th of 2020 being one of those key moments, there were short-term trend advisors, commodity trend advisors caught some of that March 20th turnaround. The medium and long-term, maybe not so much because they missed the turn, or the turn happened too quickly for them to catch it, right? And why you want to have an ensemble, which is basically a grouping of these commodity trend advisors in your portfolio. I want to spend a little time on it because I think there's a gap in, I mean, I think there's a gap in knowledge on the other side, on, you know, the cash equivalent side of what we're going to talk about. But first of all, commodity trend advisors and trend following, what is that? You have to explain that. And then if you get into the subject of ensembles, you have to explain, you know, there's CTAs that do short-term stuff. There's CTAs that do medium-term stuff. And there's CTAs that do long-term stuff. And it, you know, in the interest of time, I know, like, when you're talking to your peers in the space and to some of our co-hosts on our other show, you know, who are really familiar with this stuff, really familiar with trading futures and commodities futures, and index futures as well. You know, in the interest of time, you know, you have these terms that you use, like ensembles and term and CTAs. And, you know, and I suspect that there's not as much knowledge across the advisory landscape as there needs to be or should be, like, especially at this moment in time, you know, with the regime shift that we're having in markets towards higher for longer. So I just wanted to point that out. I think, you know, if you look at the, you know, the gold segment, the gold quarter of Harry Brown's permanent portfolio, and then, you know, along with perhaps gold, you integrate the CTAs into that strategy of getting commodities exposure and trend following exposure, diversifying that quadrant of the Harry Brown portfolio, the permanent portfolio, is where you've chosen to expand on that gold quarter, that 25% of the portfolio that's in gold, right? As a hedge against inflation.
Yeah, maybe I'll give a brief history, but first of all, I'm offended that you brought up Corey Hofstein, because how dare you bring up somebody that's so much more handsome than me, younger than me, so much smarter than me. Corey happens to be, like, my best friend, so that's great. Yeah. And he's written some great papers on rebalancing time and life. So kind of a brief history on kind of CTAs or trend following. And, you know, we kind of gave where I was going over, you know, there's, you know, 60 to 80 kind of liquid markets where you can trade across, you know, these managed futures on the commodity side or, you know, FX for your currencies, or even sometimes on the liquid indices on the financial side. But the whole point is, like, you get really broad diversification, especially across the commodity space, from CTA trend followers. Now, historically, trend following, very simple. Like we said, you know, you're buying high to sell higher or buying low to sell lower. But the way they capture those trends can be slightly different. So typically when people will read about trend following, or some people glibly look at trend following historically, and are like, well, I can just replicate that myself. And then I'm like, right. Okay, but there's some decisions that are made there that are going to make your version of CTA trend following a little bit idiosyncratic. And so historically, it's like, it could be as little as just a, you know, a trailing, you know, let's call it a 12-month trailing kind of trend line. And if it's above the trend, you're buying. If it's below, you're selling. A really binary, simple kind of chart. And then you can use, you know, you could bifurcate it as when the 2 month crosses the 12 month, that's when you're buying. And then if it goes below, that's when you're selling. Those are very simple ones. You could then start to use moving average crossovers. You can do a classical breakout, like when it's making a new high is when you're buying in, or new low is when you're buying in or shorting that low. And so there's a lot of like different little flavors to what it looks like to try to capture that trend up or capture that trend down. And then the other ways that they initially put on their positions is they'll use like maybe the trailing 10-day kind of variance or volatility of the market to position size accordingly. And then some will just let that run, what Jerry Parker calls loose pants. And then right. Some, especially the European side, or a lot of Canadians do this as well, is they'll kind of volatility target that position while it's an open position. Some believe in that, some don't. They argue vociferously about this on both sides, so I'll let them do that. My point is, there's a lot of like little nuanced decisions that are made while you're choosing, you know, your look back period, your position sizing, managing the position, that can make all these little trend followers have different outcomes and different P&Ls, even though what they look like they're doing is very similar. And so I've been a huge fan of this space for decades. And what I just found is like, if you look across them, they can have a broad dispersion of returns. You know, some years right. anywhere, you know, 30 to 60% difference in returns. And you're like, how is that possible if they're doing the same things? Well, one, they're making the different choices on when they put on the trades. But then more importantly, they can have different look back periods or trading time horizon. So some can be short term traders that are maybe looking at a period of days or weeks on their look back. The medium term ones are maybe looking back a few months, and the longer term one may be using years to figure out when that, and then right. subsequently they may be holding trades over a similar time horizon. So I found that's primarily the different ways to kind of tranche these out, is like short, medium, and long term trend followers. And to the point you made, like an example would be March of 2020, when the market's selling off so quickly, maybe the short-term traders are able to capture that down move because they're right. moving a lot faster. They got in that trade. But then maybe the medium-term trend followers maybe got whipsawed really badly, right? Because by the time it showed right. them to take the trade, they're taking the trade at the bottom, and then it reverses on them. They have a losing position. They close it out. And by the time right. they go long, they missed a lot of that comeback. And then subsequently, let's say maybe the long-term traders are looking at such a long time horizon that March is a blip and they never even changed their position. And right. so that's where the primary differences you're going to get as far as the look backs. And then within the, so I try to trunch them out when I'm looking for it. One, we try to find people that are still trading a lot, primarily commodities, which sometimes can be rare these days because they can grow the higher AUM if they trade the financials, because some of these commodity markets are smaller capacity constraints. So we try to find smaller managers that are primarily trading commodities. Then we trunch them, like I said, by look backs, short, medium, long term. And then inside that, we look for the different flavors, right? Are they using the moving average crossovers? Are they using breakouts? Are they volatility targeting the open position? So once again, trying to just build an ensemble of different managers so that way I can harness that dispersion and reduce that noise and get much more of a signal out of there. So the idea is I'm just trying to create a kind of like a beta return from commodity right. trend following advisors, right? Like if classically there's been the SocGen trend index, if that was tradable, I'd just use that, but it's not. So I had to build my own. And so we go through all that. I mean, there's some differences I would do with the SocGen trend index, but that's for another conversation. But otherwise, what I'm trying to do from harnessing as many managers and trying to tranching them out into different styles is harness that broad dispersion, reduce that noise to signal ratio, and then hopefully create a more robust beta return driver that we can get from the entire space.
Yeah. And again, uncorrelated to your offensive assets, uncorrelated to equities and bonds, and reactive to inflationary trend, inflationary volatility. I think, you know, those aspects of, you know, portfolio planning are under allocated for the most part. Like, I think for starters, if you just simplify it back to the permanent portfolio, most advisors are woefully under allocated to gold and commodities in general. Aside from it being hard to explain to the retail investor, why isn't trend following more popular?
There's so many ways to look at it. And you point out some other things. By the way, the simplified version I always use is, you know, for the last 15 years, I lived in Northern California. And, you know, whenever the price at the pump for gas would skyrocket, and my girlfriend would start complaining about it, I would say, this is why we have commodity trend followers, right? At least we're hedging some of that inflationary risk at the pump that we're experiencing every time. So I try to make that much more visceral, or when we saw the cocoa trade explode, you know, like we're
right
now, your Hershey bar or your chocolate bar costs a lot more. You know, we're hedging a lot of those commodity inputs that people are experiencing that inflationary risk these days, and, you know, food price rising, et cetera. The other one you point out that's brilliant is the correlation. You know, correlations are conditional, but like we said, in a liquidity crash, that's when correlations go to one on those offensive assets, and you find out truly what your correlations are, right? And so not only we look at the portfolio in three ways, we look at it from an offense plus defense perspective. Is this an offensive asset class or a defensive asset class?
Right.
And then we talked about the four quadrant model. But then the other way we look at it is correlations, right? And so if I say like all the offensive assets, correlations go to one, they all sell off kind of together in a stressful environment, like you pointed out, is commodity trend followers are technically uncorrelated usually to offensive assets like stocks and bonds over the long term. Like I said, correlation is kind of conditional, but also what uncorrelated also means is that half the time it can be correlated with those offensive assets, and then half the time it'll be negatively correlated. And so
yeah,
that's what I think people forget sometimes. So we look at, you know, the offensive assets are correlated, our commodity trend followers are uncorrelated, and then we get the negative correlation with our long volatility and tail risk. You know, with those, like we were talking about with that insurance,
right,
that's negatively correlated to the markets. So it's like we're looking at offense, defense, four quadrant model, and then what are the correlations, right? We want positively correlated assets, uncorrelated assets, and negatively correlated assets. And so that's why we build portfolios that way. Now, going back to your question,
but in theory, everything sounds terrific, right? It sounds really great in theory, but if you try to go to the average investor, to your retail client, with these ideas on paper, it sounds great, but when you start talking about implementation, it's a whole other ballgame. The other thing is that a lot of firms are talking up, you know, private assets, private markets, private equity, private credit, infrastructure, real estate are all diversifiers. But at the end of the day, your argument about that is that they are all also offensive assets.
Yes,
right.
I'll answer both questions. I'll take the last one.
It's just that some of those assets aren't marked to market. And
yeah,
you know, so when you have something as crazy as March 2020, the private equity just sort of sailed through that because of the rebound, that rapid rebound. They didn't have to, you know, by the time anybody, you know, got to do mark to market on any of those private assets, it was already, you know, it was done, right? It was over and done with. But I mean, it doesn't always happen that way, because like if you look back at 2007 to 2009, it wasn't the same. It was a much longer, you know, drawn out correction that happened, that in that period than what happened during COVID.
The way to look at that is like, I think like you're saying, the institutional allocators love those private deals, because like if they're only in that seat for like 3 years, they look great because it looks like a low vol asset. Like it's only making returns. They may not actually be getting cash distribution, but on their fictitious non-mark to market, you know, with their mark to model, it looks great, right? As Cliff Asen has called it, it's like volatility laundering. And then as you were saying too, it's like, to me,
it's about as good as what's happening at Bank of America right now, right? I mean, they've supposedly got $250 billion in assets, but their book value of it is about $100 and something billion. That came out recently, right? It's happening at all banks because they're holding all these health and maturity assets that have not been marked to market. And because of the BTFP facility that was put in place last year, we kind of avoided a major banking crisis, or, you know, in the regional banks, at least we kind of avoided, we skated through that because the Fed put in the BTFP window. And then, you know, they said, okay, you know, we're not going to penalize you for holding government bonds, for holding US treasuries below during this period where bond values have taken a real hit. And so, you know, they're okay, right?
Yeah.
It's illusory. It's an illusion.
Yeah. So the problem, like you're saying with bonds, is like, you actually know if you hold bonds to their terminus, what the value is. It's problem is
right.
The path along that way can be very volatile. And if you have to take those losses on the path, that's where you get in trouble. So that's why similarly, what I was calling volatility laundering is like private equity is like, if they're saying that path that they get to make up the numbers on that path is non-volatile, then it looks great to the actual, you know, waiting for the terminus. But like, as I keep asking the institutional allocators, like that I talk to all the time, is like, have you been getting your distributions from private equity? And they're like, no, over the last 18 months. So like that IRR is kind of fictitious unless you get the cash out, like to your point. And so that's one of the ways to look at that, is like that volatility, the laundering aspect of it. And then like you're saying, I believe that, you know, private equity, venture capital, real estate, all those things are just leveraged equity. You know, that's all, or private credit's leveraged, you know, bond income. That's all it is. It's just supercharged versions of these offensive assets, right? Just because you're calling them a different name, they still have the high correlations to it, and they're just a leveraged version. And then
they're diversified offensive assets. But like they're offensive diversifiers. They're not defensive diversifiers, right?
Exactly. But when times are good, like you say, when times are good, they look like they're diversifiers and it looks great to your portfolio. It's just when we get in real trouble and a true, like you're saying, protracted recession, then that's when we really find out. And once again, going back to like when the tide goes out, we see you swimming naked. But you know, you ask the question, why is CTA trend following not more popular? And I don't know, it's to me, that's like asking a barber for a haircut. Like, I don't know how to explain why it's not popular, right? Like to me, it's like, there are a couple ways I look at it. One, I think a lot of people come into investing like reading Warren Buffett books, and then they think they understand equities and a DCF model and all that stuff. I would argue they actually don't, but they think they do. And then more importantly, the way it's structured in the US and Canada and most countries in the world, it's very easy to hit the buy button on stocks and bonds or indexes for stocks and bonds. So people think it's understandable, but they don't actually look at like what's beneath the hood, like on ETFs, everything. They don't actually take the time to do due diligence and actually see what's in there. But it seems understandable because everybody's doing it and they can hit the buy button. So then if you then, you know, I grew up reading like the Market Wizards book. So I started learning about CTAs as a teenager and trend following. And it was kind of patently obvious to me of why you'd want to use this in your portfolio. And what's interesting is like every study they've ever done on some sort of efficient frontier of portfolio allocations shows you should be allocating anywhere from like 20 to 60% to commodity trend following to properly diversify a portfolio. Yet every institution that ever goes, okay, I agree with that, then they usually allocate 5% at most. So for some reason, people see the logic of it and they can't do it. Why is that the case? I'm not so certain, but what we try to do, you know, at a nominal level, we hold 50% of the portfolio in commodity trend followers. And that's higher than almost anybody I know. And the point is, if we can pair it with the stocks, bonds, the long volatility terrorists, the gold, the cryptocurrencies, then hopefully we kind of hide it in the overall portfolio. So it gets people to hold something that they may not understand or potentially don't like. I think it goes back to what I started with, is like people understand buy low, sell high. They don't understand buy high, sell higher, or buy low, sell lower. So I think it's just like the kind of switch in mentality. But anytime you plug it into some sort of portfolio optimization, it shows it vastly improves your portfolio to have commodity trend followers. And then more importantly, it vastly improves that portfolio. Like you said, if you have a protracted recession like 2008 or, you know, like a slow drawdown like we had in 2020, they tend to do well there. And then more importantly, those inflationary environments is when you're going to have a higher beta of inflation. And that's going to protect your portfolio hopefully better than anything else.
Is it just that when advisors go to their clients with this, that they're running into resistance? And then, you know, what started out as a plan to add 20% gets cut back to 5 or something like that?
Yeah, I think it's turtles all the way down from multiple perspectives, right? Is I just look at like the incentives. Like, for example, I'm unfortunately not as up to par on the history of kind of the Canadian financial markets, but in the US financial markets, historically, everything is driven people's savings in their 401ks and their IRAs towards 60-40 portfolios and an indexation, especially with target date funds. So all of the laws and the provisions are already moving everybody towards that. And, you know, people can argue their conspiracy theories of why. Then the second part of it is that, you know, a financial advisor, they want a CYA, right? They do not want to look different from their neighbor, right?
They don't want to change their investment policy statement either. They don't want to have to rewrite all their contracts with their clients.
Yeah, why go out on a limb, right? If the guy down the street, they're all doing the same thing, why don't I do the same thing, clip the coupon? But I'm not blaming them in the sense that, like, it's also the client. This is why I say turtles all the way down. It's also the clients, right? If they're not keeping up with their neighbors, like, if you add something, what people consider different, alternative, or esoteric, like commodity trend following, and over a short-term period, like a few months or a few quarters, and it underperforms 60-40, and your neighbor's bragging about their 60-40, you know, their stock bond portfolio, people are going to really complain. And so that's the thing. It's short-termism. It's, you know, keeping up with the Joneses next door. It's managers not wanting to look different. I mean, and then the laws in the U.S., I don't know about Canada, but like everything's leading towards, let's just easily hit the buy button on target date funds and then just we're done. You know, why look different? Why do anything different? Even though I would argue what we do is we're trying to actually protect the client's portfolio and build wealth. And that's why we built it for ourselves and our families. And if other people like it, great. But otherwise, I can't convince anybody that has never heard of this stuff or not looking for this stuff that why they should have it. Usually it's going to be people that already know they need it and are looking for it. And we're, you know, maybe the best solution or somebody else is. So that's the thing I find. It's really hard if somebody's never thought about this or never experienced the pain of those drawdowns. That's why I said the GFC earlier, the Great Financial Crisis in real estate never happened in Canada. Whereas I always like, I think it was Jason Zweig that said, like, I can draw you a picture of a snake, but if I throw a snake in your lap, you're going to have a very different reaction. And so if you haven't lived through those 50, 60% drawdowns and those liquidity events where, you know, you want to curl up in the fetal position on the floor and you go catatonic, then it's really hard to convince you of why you would want any defensive assets.
Yeah, exactly. And to your point, I mean, you're absolutely right. We didn't have the subprime mortgage crisis in Canada. Right, which just put millions and millions of homes underwater. And, you know, so that may explain why American retail investors are farther ahead on risk management than Canadian investors, right? So that may go a long way. But so I think trend following is something investors, advisors are warming up to. Even here in Canada, I think, you know, I think when it's packaged properly as well, that will help. I think, you know, that's where ETFs are making, you know, both ETFs and funds, but ETFs as wrappers for these strategies is starting to make it easier to integrate some of these components into a portfolio, these defensive assets into portfolios. The one that's not so easy to do is the cash equivalent portion in the permanent portfolio, which is, it's easy, obviously, to have, I mean, it's not easy to have 25% of your assets in cash at any given time. You know, most fund managers' experience is that that's not possible because they're expected to be fully invested all the time if you're looking at a fund manager. But for an individual portfolio, cash is something you want at a very basic level, is something you want for those moments when there are buying opportunities, like March 2020. But it's not very efficient, right? It's not capital efficient, for one, to hold cash, especially if you go back to March of 2020, interest rates were close to zero. So, you know, what do you get for it? And that's the problem, is that there's a drag. It's either a drag on the portfolio to have cash, Or conversely, if you're looking at you know, the things that you seek to replace some of the cash with, it's expensive. It could be viewed as potentially expensive if you don't do it right. It is the long volatility tail risk strategy that you propose for the cash quadrant of the Harry, you know, of the permanent portfolio. Insurance is also a hard concept to drive with retail investors as well, because there's a cost. There's that premium bleed that you talked about. There's a cost for insurance, right? Like, how much is this going to cost the portfolio? A lot of times, like, you know, if you like look at long short strategies, one pays, you know, one side of the long short strategy pays for the other side of the long short strategy, right? You get some premium, you get some cash flow from holding, you know, whether it's, you know, selling options or selling calls or puts, or just going long or short, you're getting some offsetting yield that pays for the insurance. But if you're just looking at a quarter of a portfolio to be that insurance portion, that starts to make sense, because then you're only allocating up to a quarter of the portfolio where there's going to be a cost, right? And you have the other three parts of the portfolio doing their jobs. That one quarter of the portfolio that you know was in the permanent portfolio allocated towards cash, your idea is to put that to better use, to more capital efficient use, right? So what is, first of all, what is long volatility and tail risk?
Sure. Another way to look at what we're calling offensive assets is their short volatility. Meaning if there's any sort of volatile path in the market or any sort of global event, that's when those correlations go to one, those things sell off together.
Right.
So most offensive assets are short volatility. That's what I mean by volatility. Like they can't handle any sort of perturbations. Long volatility is the opposite. It does.
You're betting on volatility.
Exactly. You're hoping, yeah. When things go haywire or go, you know, multiple standard deviations in the wrong direction, this is when volatility explodes and you're riding that wave up of that volatility and you're hopefully profiting from that volatility. And that's what a long volatility position would be. Similarly, like a tail risk, like we're saying, the insurance has a long volatility or long convexity profile to it as well. The idea of why it's better than cash, like you're saying, is like the cost or the portfolio effect of the dead cash problem, right? You have to hold a lot of cash for it to be valuable, right? And those sell-offs like March 2020 or 2008, cash is very valuable. It's an awesome thing to have. But it just has like a linear value. It might be much more valuable than it was before because now you can buy things for cheaper. And if you have cash on hand, nobody else does, right, then you get a better deal. But it has a kind of more of a linear effect where we want more of a convex effect. And this is a toy model, but let's say you were paying a 2% insurance premium on your portfolio every year. And then you have that 1 in 5, 10, 15 year event. And let's say that is now worth 30, 40, 50%, right? It has much more bang for your buck, so to speak,
right,
than you can get from the cash position. And so that's one way of looking at it. And the other reason you have portfolio insurance, as Nassim Taleb said, is if you don't have insurance, you don't have a portfolio. The other way I try to say it is like, the way to think about that is like, what does that mean, not having a portfolio? It's like, imagine having a $10 million beach house and not having home insurance on it, and a hurricane,
right,
comes and wipes it out. You better have $10 million on cash to be able to subsidize that, right? Because you,
right,
didn't have your insurance. So he's saying similarly, portfolio effects are very similar. But to your point about capital efficiency, the reason we build the defensive side of the portfolio with this long volatility, tail risk, and commodity trend advisors is because we can use these what are called derivative instruments in managed futures or option strategies. On the long volatility and tail risk, we use option strategies that have that embedded convexity to them. And the important part is, like, you know what your bleed is, what the cost of that insurance is, but you don't know how convex your return is going to be. And so we like that positively skewed profile that you get from long volatility assets. And more importantly, because they're in options and managed futures, we don't have to put up as much cash to get that convexity. So it makes it a much more capital efficient usage of your portfolio. At a high level, the way to kind of look at it is if, you use Harry Brown's four quadrants, say we use four quadrants and we're in global stocks, global bonds, our long volatility and tail risk and our trend following, well, that'd be 25% each, like what you're referencing. Well, what we're able to do is use that implicit capital efficiency we get from the futures and options market, where we lever up that portfolio a little bit, so it's 50% each. And we're having very small cash outlay on that long volatility and tail risk options, and a very small cash outlay in that managed futures trend following. And so that allows us to then kind of hold those linear positions in the stocks and bonds of those offensive assets better, and use much more capital efficiency to really manage the defensive side of that book that has a lot of convexity to it. So the idea is, hopefully, you know, if then we're 50% global stocks, 50% global bonds, during the good times, like we're just as optimistic as everybody else. We hope the good times keep rolling, so you participate in that. And then when the bad times inevitably happen, hopefully we have a lot of convexity that jumps out from behind the curtain and saves your bacon a little bit. And then more importantly,
right,
you then rebalance back in those offensive assets. And that's what helps you really compounding effectively. So you're reducing those drawdowns or those left tail risks. Then you're also rebalancing at the lower NAV point on those offensive assets, which helps you effectively compound your wealth over time. And so that's kind of the way we look at the portfolio. And so similarly, as we use an ensemble of managers on the trend following side, we do the similar on the long volatility and tail risk side. We're in 14 managers because there's a lot of different path dependencies to a sell-off and to a volatility event. And once again, you know, how are managers handling that? What's the very niche strategy that they're doing to try to capture that? Because if these events happen once every 10 years, you better make certain that you're going to monetize that correctly, or else you're going to have egg on your face. And so the way we ensure that is by having this broad diversification over different paths of sell-offs to make sure, even if a few of our managers miss monetizing it correctly, you know, the bulk of our managers, the majority do, we have a much higher probability of capturing a convex return profile if there is a dramatic liquidity event. And then the reason we try to pair this long volatility and these commodity trends together, the way I look at it is the long volatility and tail risk does unbelievably well in these liquidity cascade events like we had in March of 2020. And I was always banging the drum is like, yeah, you may have stocks, bonds, and even if you have trend following in your portfolio, like I said, they're uncorrelated, but sometimes that means they can be correlated. So they all could be on the wrong side of that vent. If the liquidity event is very acute, the trend followers could be on the wrong side. And now your trend following that you're using for kind of protection was on the wrong side of the trade too. So you had all of your asset classes going down together.
Right.
If you had that true negative correlation convexity that you can get from those put options, that's what really saves you in a March 2020 event and those liquidity cascades. And then more importantly, if you have a more protracted recession or you have a very slow drip drawdown that's not really spiking volatility like we saw in 2020, that's when commodity trend advisors are going to do much better than maybe a long volatility or tail risk manager. And that's why people got kind of turned off by volatility in 2020 because they experienced that event. So similarly, that's why the pairing of those two together kind of covers your basis for any sort of defensive action that could potentially take place. And then within those, you know, we use fractal diversification, meaning, you know, if you keep looking further and further down, it's just getting more and more diversified because we just want to make sure that once again, we're reducing the noise, capturing a higher signal, because I'm just trying to get a beta-like return from long volatility and tail risk as well, and to make sure I have a higher probability of ensuring I capture that event so I can sleep at night.
Yeah. So now, convexity, that's where, you know, your insurance, the cost of your insurance versus an asymmetric payoff is what we're talking about, right? You're talking about like where insurance costs you 2 or 3% a year. You're using that quarter, which is still going to be mostly in cash, except that you're using the cash to support the futures the futures bets that you're making in the long ball and tail risk categories, right? And the whole point is that if that liquidity cascade event where all correlations go to one occurs, you're going to get the asymmetric payoff from your insurance in that quarter of your portfolio, right? And that's wonderful, but the whole point of it is also that you deploy by rebalancing, right? The rebalancing is like in all that we're talking about, you know, these having these four assets, you know, stocks, bonds, long tail, long volatility, tail risk, and CTAs in those four quadrants, this strategy really works extremely well if rebalanced.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And the other way to think about convexity is acceleration, right? Like that's the other thing that convexity has.
You're getting that asymmetric payoff, right? You're getting the asymmetric payoff from that insurance that you've installed in your, that you've put in your portfolio. And I love that. I mean, it makes all the sense in the world when you say, you know, you'd be a fool not to insure any home for that matter, but you know, your $10 million beach house with no insurance on it could be wiped out by a bad storm just like that. And if you don't have the insurance, you know, you better have the cash, right? So,
yeah, exactly. So that's what I said. So you have a large cash problem. So why I was saying acceleration too is a way to think about it is if you have positive convexity, if that sell off accelerates and everything, you're accelerating, you know, beyond that. So it has a nice kind of curve to it, and it ramps up. So it's more about the thing about the acceleration of convexity as the sell down as a sell off is faster and deeper. You're actually accelerating the positiveness of your payout. So that's why it has that curvature that you get. Convexity, which would mean, and then the negative convexity would be if you're selling insurance, right? Like you're collecting premium, bad stuff starts to happen, no big deal, but all of a sudden you get knocked in and now you owe a full payment. So that has that negative convexity to it,
right?
It accelerates as the market goes down. So that's one way to look at kind of the convexity. Then more importantly, like you're saying, rebalancing, the way we look at portfolios is like reinvesting. Rebalancing is key to a portfolio. So what are your heuristics for rebalancing? So what we think is beautiful about combining offensive and defensive assets or a four quadrant model is the rebalancing effect. So let's take a toy model of March 2020. The stock market sells off, but now you have this convex position, let's say on your tail risk, that is hopefully like covering that loss. But so now you have this convex cash position on your tail risk, but your stocks are, you know, down, substantially. Well,
they could be down 50, 60%, right? They could be down, like we've seen that. We've seen that in the last 15, 20 years a couple of times, right? We've seen, March of 2020, stocks were down 40% roughly. We've seen, in some cases a lot more. And then we've seen the GFC where, the S&P 500 closed at, what was the magic number? 666.
Yeah, exactly. I'll let you say it.
Who would have thought that, right? And if you're at that moment, if you had this windfall from your long volatility tail risk position, like what better situation is that than to be able to invest that across all your cratered assets and rebalance that whole permanent portfolio at that moment in time? You'd be patting yourself on your back the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's why I always say that, like, that's why I brought up Jason Zweig's, like, I can draw you a picture of a snake or I could throw a snake in your lap. I have a lot of young people say, if the market's down 30 to 50%, I'm a buyer. And I go, oh yeah. I was like, have you lived through that before? No, they haven't, because we all know when the market's down 30 to 50%, like you think it's never coming back. Right. And usually,
that's right,
the bulk of retail investors will crystallize those losses at the bottom and then not participate in any sort of return. So it's like you get a double whammy of making that situation incredibly worse, because understandably fear has made you force you to take behavioral mistakes. So like to your point is like March 2020 happens, April 1st, 2020, and this is why we like our total portfolio dilution of cockroach is like, who's buying stocks April 1st, 2020? We are, because we have this convex cash position and from our tail risk. So now we can buy those stocks at that lower NAV point you're talking about, because everybody says they'd like to buy there. But unless you have a behavioral function that forces you to, because we rebalance monthly, that's what we're saying. That's what protects and redeploys that capital when you need it most. And then similarly in 2022, like you said, the whole world got crushed on stocks and bonds. But then, commodity trend following was the ballast of that portfolio. So it's allowing you to, once again, to rebalance into that drawdown. So it's this forced scaling into trades that we all know we should do behaviorally. Assets are selling off, we should maybe be rebalancing into those assets so that way we can get better compounding over the long run. But it's very hard for people to do behaviorally. So as long as you have it systematized and you have truly, balance between offense and defense, and you have true balance between the correlations of positive, uncorrelated, and negatively correlated,
right,
that's what allows you to truly forcibly rebalance. And that forces you good behavioral strategies to make sure you effectively compound your wealth efficiently over time.
It just goes against human nature, right? So to have that monthly automatic rebalance is really important here. I mean, to have a systematic rebalancing program where you're not thinking about it, you're just doing it, it's just happening, is incredibly important to this whole process that we've talked about today, right? Which is,
it might be the most valuable thing we do.
Yeah.
And it's hard to talk about, right? Because it sounds very, paternalistic or pedantic to tell your clients like this is a babysitter tax, we're holding your hand to force you to do the right thing.
I think a lot of advisors would say, duh, okay, that's fine.
It sounds
just go ahead and do it.
Terrible to your client, right? Because we all want to think we're intelligent, good looking, make the best decisions, we're the best drivers, we're kind people. But during the emotionality, we may not do the right thing. So it's great to have a better system, or like even Meb always talks about too, people don't even have a system written down, let alone will they adhere to a system, Most people don't have a written, mandate of what they're going to do with their investing portfolio. But there's other things you said in there too, like my buddies at Alpha Architects had a great article a long time ago about even God would get fired as an investment manager, because like the right thing to do, I think when they wrote the article was like 100% hold an Amazon stock, but you had experienced a 92% drawdown and nobody,
right,
if God was managing that portfolio, had a 90%, everybody's firing it, right? But then it was like, that was that if you had perfect hindsight, that was actually the best thing to do. And then going back is like why, I think this relates to having our broad diversification and really having that rebalancing effect and that broad diversification, why we think that is, vitally important to a portfolio is like, and why you ask like why people won't include trend following or maybe won't include some of these other things is because, as Brian Portnoy says, true diversification means always having to say you're sorry.
Right.
And the hard part about that is, right, like there's always part of your portfolio that you're going to hate, that you're going to watch the news media is going to tell you it's terrible, right? Like in 2022, it might have been like volatility, you know, but you in 2020, you would have loved volatility, right? And then now maybe people think, trend following is come and gone. Or more importantly, people are like, why would you ever hold bonds? So if you're not like really depressed or feel like you want to throw up about part of your portfolio, then in my opinion, you're not truly diversified. If you're happy with every piece of your portfolio and everything's going up, that right. means you know you have all like very correlated investments and they're all going to go down together. But that I think is hard for us to deal with because going back, like I said, we all want to think we're smart or handsome, you know, or all those things. And so it's hard for us to admit that like this part of my portfolio sucks, but in the future, a different part of my portfolio will suck. So it's more about mitigating that risk. And more importantly, the way I think about it is like, I'm trying to reduce that luck surface. I feel like a lot of people, right. especially in their investments, you hear all the time about luck, right? Like who is long NVIDIA, right? That's all you're hearing about these days is those people that were long NVIDIA. That's getting lucky. I'm trying to reduce that luck surface and having yeah. a more consistent return profile over time and make sure I can sleep at night.
A lot of people in Canada thought they were going to be lucky with Nortel,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Nortel Networks, right? I mean,
yep.
So you know, anybody who went through that is looking at the market now with the same sort of skepticism when you have a handful of names driving all the return or the majority of the return, right? I really love the whole analogy around Herschel Walker. Can you talk about that just to
sure.
cap off everything yep. we've talked about? Because, yeah, you know, it makes a great deal of sense to end on that note.
Yeah, hopefully I can remember it well enough to tell the story perfectly, but otherwise you can find it on our website too to get all the details of that. But also like kind of like touching on what you just said, I actually have a totally opposite view in a way. Like I actually, no offense, I don't want people to watch this show. I don't want people to think about their investments, right?
Yeah.
The whole point is like you worked really hard to have the savings and you just need your savings to outpace inflation and be there when you need it most. And I would like to go back to like a pre-1980s and everything when you didn't have your portfolio on your phone. Like the average Robinhood person checks their portfolio yeah. 8 times a day. How is that helpful to you? So if you have a properly diversified portfolio of offensive and defensive assets, et cetera, you can forget about those savings and you can go back to your daily life and enjoy spending time with your family, with your friends, doing your hobbies, whatever work you love. Like this whole thing that investing in our portfolios is like front and center in our lives. I think is really sad to me. Like, that's what I'm trying to get at. Like, I hope people yeah. watch this and then never watch another show again about investing, right? Like, go back and enjoy your lives, enjoy your families. But the Herschel Walker trade was also known as the Great Train Robbery. And so the idea was in the 1980s, the Dallas Cowboys, they drafted Herschel Walker. And Herschel Walker turned into one of the best running backs in history. He's the Hall of Fame running back for the Dallas Cowboys. What was really interesting, I think he had over like 8,000 rushing yards, close to 5,000 receiving yards. And that was at a time when running backs didn't do a lot of receiving threat. And I think it was over 60 touchdowns. So he was an incredible individual right. player. And the Minnesota Vikings decided they needed an incredible individual player to win a Super Bowl. So they did everything they could to trade with the Dallas Cowboys to get Herschel Walker. And at the time they traded, I think it was essentially around 5 draft picks, most of which were first rounds. And then I actually read recently, or it was really interesting how the Dallas Cowboys even parlayed those 5 picks into 8 picks as they traded them around. So essentially, they got 8 picks for one player. So Dallas Cowboys were thinking about the right. team, and the Minnesota Vikings were thinking about the individual player. Well, when the Minnesota Vikings then got Herschel Walker, he had some injuries, he had some other issues. He wasn't the player he formerly was with the Cowboys, and they didn't end up winning a Super Bowl. The Dallas Cowboys took those 8 draft picks and went out and got a bunch of future all-stars with, you know, whether it's Emmitt Smith, the running back, Woodson. They got an amazing amount of different players, and they won 3 Super Bowls throughout the 80s and 90s. And so that's how they became what was known as America's team, is because it's that Dallas team. So once again, Dallas was thinking about the ensemble right. of their portfolio of players, and Minnesota Vikings were thinking about a team. And that's why it was called the Great Train Robbery or the Herschel Walker Syndrome, is because the way Dallas won out of that deal was able to win 3 Super Bowls, and we never kind of heard from the Minnesota Vikings for a long time after that.
Yeah, that's perfect. That's such a perfect analogy for all that we've talked about today. Jason, really great to catch up with you, and even better to get your insight and get your explanation of what it is to have defense along with offense in the portfolio. I'm thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and your insight.
Great talking to you. I appreciate it. Hopefully I dispelled some myths, made it hopefully a little bit more legible, and I didn't confuse people even more. But it's always great talking to you, and I really appreciate the time.